Hey there, Danny with Right Foot Down. I messed up this ad read so many times because I really want to tell you about Track Monkey Apparel. They make great quality, enthusiast shirts along with hats, stickers, watches, patches, you name it. A couple of my personal favorites are their Life is Better at the Track tee and their One Track Mind tee. You should really check them out and see for yourself. Their products are great for you or the gearhead in your life. Visit trackmonkeyapparel.com.
You're listening to the Untitled Car Show in partnership with RightFootDown.com. Visit RightFootDown for your daily automotive fix. If you enjoyed today's program, please tell a friend. It's the best way to support this show. If you want to visit the archives, go to YouTube and search for Untitled Car Show. That'll bring you to the archived episodes. If you want to follow the show, just search for Untitled Car Show on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. You can always send an email to the show at untitledcarshow@rightfootdown.com. We're so glad you decided to spend the next hour or so with us. Without further ado, let's get into today's program. Hi, everyone. Before we get into it, Ben's audio got a little scratchy at certain points. I did my best to make sure that nothing got cut out and left on the floor. I've left it all on, you know, audio tape for you or whatever they say, not the cutting room floor. So just be aware of that. Some spots get a little spotty, but I've tried to do the best with editing to make sure that you get as much Ben Collins as possible. Let's get into the show. Thank you for joining us this evening. I am here with a person you should probably know if you know anything about cars. He's been a race car driver, a stunt car driver, a Stig, a television presenter. He is a, you know, basically what every kid wants to grow up to be. It is Mr. Ben Collins. Ben, how are you doing this evening?
I'm very good, thanks. I guess it's morning here and the evening for you or something like that.
You know, I'm just so used to doing these interviews a little later in the day that evening is just kind of what comes out. So,
I hope you've had some coffee. So it's going to keep you going. You're going to need some endurance for this one.
Just a little bit of espresso so far. Brett, there's a few things I kind of ask every guest, and sometimes I save these for later, but I kind of want to get right into them with you. These are what I call the inside the actor's studio questions. And it's just some fairly simple stuff. I'm not quite sure. Do you have inside the actor's studio over there in England?
No. What is that?
So it's a like long-running series here where they bring on actors. They ask them kind of silly, simple questions, and then they deep dive into a conversation after that about the, you know, their history as a, you know, actor and what they do. And it's long running series. It typically makes sense to the American people, but I realized that doesn't quite make sense to anyone who's not from here. So, the questions are basically just, you know, simple questions off the top of your head, you know, as a automotive, you know, enthusiast, these questions can kind of change day by day. To give you a good example of one, the first one right off the top is, what's your favorite car?
Favorite car? Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, I suppose, of all the things I've driven, the one that was most exciting and did stick was the Porsche Carrera GT, which is kind of the most un-Porsche-like Porsche. From what I understand in the history of it, Porsche decided to go and do Formula One. They created this incredible V10 engine. Then they didn't do Formula One, and they thought, what do we do with the engine? They built a car around it, and that was the Carrera GT. So, as far as I know, really, they're one and only modern mid-engine car. And it's a massive machine. With incredible, the V10 just makes the most incredible sound of any modern road car. It's such a high-pitched, freakish noise it makes. You've got to be certainly precise with it. So, funny enough, the first two laps I took with it, I managed to spin twice in the same place, which was unusual for me because I thought I would have known by then. until I really got to feel what the car was doing, because it was extremely nervous and sensitive over bumps. Your feet sort of sat on the deck, and it was very easy to make a micro movement with your foot that affected the power and span up the rear wheels, as I learnt. But then, yeah, after two laps, the thing fit like a glove, and you just really were able to get the most out of it, which was extremely rewarding.
So what is your least favorite car?
That would be the TVR. So I don't know if, unfortunately, I think the American market has been largely spared the TVR. And in fact, the business went bust. So they don't make them anymore, which is also a good thing. I never really, I mean, they are fun. They're big, brutal. I suppose it's the British version of a muscle car in a way, except that they're completely beguiling. It would lure you in. You had a kind of sense of how much grip the car should have, which it never did. So you kind of used to spin out whenever you went through a corner. It was the weight was not very well supported. It had lots of power. They were unreliable. Cool stuff like that. Everything about the car I found frustrating, and particularly when you try to put it through its paces, it was pretty good. They looked good, actually, in a way. Some of them looked pretty aggressive and mean, and it's maybe sexy, but that was kind of it. So that was the least favorite.
They're kind of like pantomime performance cars without much behind it, kind of backing it up, which is
that's a great way to put it. A pantomime, exactly. Yeah.
So then what modification trend? I'm curious about this one. So, you know, the people who lower their cars to people who, you know, lift them up. I'm not quite sure if you have these guys over in England again, people who take their cars, lift them up to high hell and, you know, throw on exhaust, you know, the tuner people, like what modification trend, do you find yourself maybe not wanting to do to your own vehicle, but something that you see out on the street and you can appreciate at least for an aesthetic value?
Yeah, I think some of the stuff that some people do is, you know, fantastic. It makes me laugh. The bouncing and the hydraulics where you can jack your car up and down, you know, when they're done well, they are kind of works of art, really. And that's a great expression, and they're fun. And generally speaking, people aren't doing that so they can drive them faster or harder through a corner. I guess where it gets interesting is when people start lowering them. That's always interesting. And I've driven some of these where people have kind of messed around with what was previously a perfectly good car, and they've made it into a complete dog. It's interesting. But on the whole, I think when things are done at the lower end of the scale, it doesn't tend to work out too well. And I think one of the giveaways I've generally found is downlighting. Vehicles with downlighting tend to have been pimped pretty badly. I'm not sure that's always true, but as a general rule, I'm not so sure about that. I think that's the last thing I would do to mine.
Well, that answers the next question then, because that was what was the least favorite thing or the thing you would least want done to your own vehicle. So makes that fairly simple. So
I think downlighting. Or possibly a neon pink is not something I would go for. I prefer, if I had it, I'd be happier in something like the Dumb and Dumber vehicle than I would be in one with down lighting.
Well, that makes sense to me. So what car do you dread being stuck behind at a red light?
Oh, wow. A red light. Mm-hmm. Oh, hang on! It's nearly there. I'm just trying to work it out. It's on the tip of my tongue. Probably a Nissan, I'm guessing, because usually they're pretty slow getting away, and they tend to be pretty cautious. But that's probably a little bit unfair. To be honest, I try and be pretty relaxed these days, and not get het up about that. I think that's probably something that used to be a big affliction of mine when I was about 18, and I was frustrated behind every car at traffic lights. And these days, it really doesn't matter. So I try and zen these days.
I gotcha. What automotive sound or noise do you love?
The V10. And I know I talked about the Porsche Carrera GT, but I was very, very fortunate to race in the early 2000s at the in Le Mans in a V10-powered Le Mans prototype. if you've never heard one, then you know, it's difficult to describe it. But it's kind of like if you ever found yourself in Clash of the Titans and facing down the Kraken and it screamed at you, I guess that's probably how it would sound. Based in America as well, we went to Sebring for the 12 hours, and there were a lot of turbocharged cars coming in at that time. So we were the only vehicles with this sounding V10 screamer. Mm. And it was great. We used to get standing ovation every single lap for 12 hours at turn 9, I think it was. People just loved it. And of course, the bumpy track at Sebring really played havoc with the drivetrain. We used to get wheel spin in the first three gears. So you'd be coming out with an engine buzzing off the rev limiter, and people just love that. Is that what we were talking about? Best engine, best sound?
Best sound, yes.
I've never seen anything top it. It was you know, a Formula One engine, basically. And that was the era, the 90s, when F1 had the meatiest sounding engines. I suppose, actually, the best ever I've heard was the Ferrari F1 car that John O'Lacey drove, because our team owner owned that car. I think it revved to something like 17,000 RPM. I hope I've got that right. And a sweet sound has never been made. It beggars belief that the pistons can do that. And yes, that was the golden era. It would never be the same, but you know, obviously things are changing now with electric in a different way. But the sound, we obviously peaked in the 90s.
I would agree with that. A good sounding V10 is phenomenal, and especially those old Le Mans, naturally aspirated and F1 vehicles. Yep. So then, what is your least favorite sounding engine? Or not engine, I'm sorry. What's your least favorite automotive noise? I'm already on the engine thing. So, more coffee, Ike.
Yep. Well, I guess a lot of the turbocharged engines always sound disappointing. We switched from, I went from V10 in the Le Mans prototype to a V8, which was okay. It was still pretty powerful, and it had a good snap to it. And then we ended up with a turbocharged engine, and you think it just doesn't sound as cool as it should. Mm-hmm. Down to a sort of turbo diesel road car engine, pretty underwhelming, I suppose. There's good talk there. I my basically link and associate the sound with the way they drive, because you're always teasing with the torque and trying to anticipate when the power is going to come in. Whereas naturally aspirated, you feel every millimeter of the throttle has a response with the way the chassis reacts in response to that. You feel much more in control. With the turbos, you've got to get very good at anticipating what will happen at a certain point in the corner, and that's always a juggling act. So yeah, least favorite sound, I suppose, is turbos. Not all, because you know, some of the sexier stuff, like the Porsche turbo, they sound wonderful with the pop-off valve going. And going older again, you go back to the old Le Mans cars and some of the old road cars with crazy turbos, and even bigger lag. So you'd think that I'd be complaining about, but actually, when they're really tuned in well, they were so much fun. It was ridiculous power. So I guess it's a dreary turbo diesel is bottom of the list.
I agree with that. I think they're a little bit more of a, turbo diesel is a little bit more of a blight over there than they are over here as well. So,
you're going to see that mostly in the States.
The Volkswagen tried for a bit, but then something happened. I don't remember what. And then they all got taken away. So, and then this is, I got two questions I absolutely love to ask everyone here, and I think they're the most important questions you can ask anyone, especially of your skill level of driving here, which is, what is the hardest food to eat while driving?
Yeah, I think it's burger. I'm pretty sure. I was a bit naughty as a younger driver, and I took to eating things like, I had a Whopper, one of those Burger King Whopper, sorry. Which is quite complicated at the best of times, and you've got the onions and the lettuce and all those things have kind of falling out. It's really not something you'd eat in the car at all. I'm hold my hand up and say that was a bad thing to do. And yeah, that it's far too complicated because the box isn't the right shape. It's there's stuff going everywhere. You end up with mayonnaise on your lap, and then people look at you really strangely. Then it looks pretty odd. So I would avoid a small snack. You're ready to go. You know, keep you going. And I mean, the most important thing is having water with you, because hydration and driving don't mix. They mix really badly. You lose a lot of concentration. So yeah, and just pull over for the Whopper and you really enjoy it.
I will say, I think
maybe KFC actually.
Yeah, I was gonna say the burger, like here in the States, is something we just do without even thinking about it. But I will say, I will give you that I think Burger King has a particularly hard burger to eat because they like to slab everything with mayo, which just makes everything want to slide out. I'm not putting this up on the wall of fame, though, you know, but it's a good one. I'll give you that. It's a good. And now, and then, what is the hardest makeup to apply while driving?
I would say it would have to be eyeliner, surely. Mm-hmm. Which is admittedly not something I do very regularly, but I think eyeliner whilst at the wheel is probably got to be tough. You're probably wondering how does Ben know anything about eyeliner, and I don't have a secret fetish, but for some of the films we have to wear a lot of makeup to look like we've been beaten up and all that sort of stuff, and it's the one thing I hate having stuff on my eyes, and it's even sitting still it feels like you're poked direct in the eyeball. So I can only imagine what that's like if you try and do it while you're driving. So yeah, I think the girls have it worst if they're when they're in a hurry and sitting up in traffic. I think it's got to be dangerous.
That's another typical reply with that, and I agree, and I especially agree because you get into a crash while applying eyeliner, and that's not ending well. So
it's bad.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of the end of our Inside the Actor Studio questions there, Mr. Collins. It's, you know, so we kind of into our normal segments here, and I appreciate you dealing with my little goofy questions. So let's kind of get into, you know, what you're doing now, I think is a great one. So you have been a Top Gear presenter. You've been, you know, Fifth Gear. You've worked with a wonderful charity, which, you know, gets guys who are, you know, wounded, you know, veterans into vehicles. You've been, you know, basically every type of race car driver on the planet, including my own favorite series, the Le Mans series. So what is it that you're up to these days besides writing some wonderful books?
Oh, well, yeah. Well, thanks for saying that. Well, I still am chasing the dream, which I still love racing. It's just become a very difficult career to pursue because the series has become so much more expensive and a lot of the teams are finding it very difficult to keep the funding going. And without that, the cars don't run. So that's still something I would love to do. I've still got my racing license. I'm hoping to get back at Le Mans next year, but I'll wait and see. So that's still very much in the you know mindset. I guess what I've been busiest on recently has been a virtual racing series. So for about the last 5 or 6 years, I've been working on Project Cars, which is the simulation racing game. And I love that because genuinely it gives me a big outlet for the need for speed. We've created something that is extremely close to the real thing and actually giving people an opportunity to get around exactly the problem I described, which is you can pick up a copy of the game for $40, download it onto your PC, play it on PlayStation, Xbox, whatever, and then you're away. And thank esports has become a professional online and live racing series. You can really compete. You can actually earn a living. There's professional teams there and professional drivers doing that, just that. So that's been keeping me pretty busy. Other things like, you know, the usual stuff, the stunt driving for movies, which I love because that's going out there and doing what I love doing the most, which is controlling cars situations and trying to make it look cool. So I've been having a lot of fun with that as well.
I that's one of the things I was curious about. So you got into racing first, obviously, and then into the stunt car section like later on. Like, how did you get pulled into doing that?
Yeah, well, I it was interesting. I was doing some, so when I was racing in single seaters, I was doing Formula 3 in Europe, and before I went to America, started doing Indy style racing and a bit of NASCAR, and I was doing some work with a company that we did car, they did car launches and that sort of thing, and I got a TV commercial to do. So we went to go and do this commercial, and it snowed on the track, and the producer was crying, and they realized, you know, they thought they were washed out, and I thought, this is just playtime. This is going to be amazing. We can slide the car through and pass the camera. We could do all great stuff, having never worked with a camera crew before. So we completely reinvented their commercial, and they loved it. It went really well. I had a great time doing it. Realized that this filming business, you know, could be really fun. So from that, I then applied for a job at Top Gear. Well, I got at least onto the list enough to get an audition and go to the track and turn some times or whatever. I heard nothing from them. But 3 months later, I did hear from them, and they hired me. So it worked out well. And, you know, as it turned out, my times had been the quickest they had there, and that was great. So that got me into television, again, filming. And from there, yeah, who doesn't watch movies and think, I'd love to do that? So that's what I did. I went to some of the production companies that with the studios. And got hold of the stunt coordinator for the James Bond movies, and went and had a meeting, and he hired me, which I think so. I got actually started with a Nicolas Cage movie called National Treasure 2. We did a huge car chase around London, and really how that happened was kind of strange, because I'd just broken four of my ribs and a bone in my neck in a big crash, racing in GT. And I was unusable for racing for about at least a month. And the phone rang with this opportunity. So I jumped into that and did a chase 3 months. And that was driving career got started.
I think that's one of the, you know, signs that you're really addicted to something, where you are unusable as a race car driver. So, hey, why not, you know, you're too banged up to be a race car driver. So why not just go drive some cars around the city street? Because that's, you know, at super fast speed, because that makes a lot more sense. That's a lot safer, right, than a racetrack?
It's one of those things. I mean, to turn lap times consistently, you do a qualifying time, you give it everything to produce one fast time, and to be really successful, you need to try and replicate that performance every lap in a long distance race or a GT race. And to do it, it's extremely physical. And especially in the GT cars, you get really hot. You're clamoring for air. You're strapped into the thing. There is no way you can do that with broken ribs. You could have a go. You could do okay, but you can't. You couldn't be in the top level. You can't be in that percent where you're finding the extra piece of time from your imagination and unleashing it. Sort of those final critical 0.3 that put you in front. You're not going to do it when your body is screaming. So, however, for the stunt driving stuff, it's a little bit different. Thankfully, there were a lot of down days. You're kind of waiting around to do your thing. But I could tolerate the pain in short bursts, and filming tends to be a bit like that. So I'd be strapped into what was called a pod car. This is when we put a cage on the roof of a car to disconnect the controls inside the real car. So the actors are inside, but they're not actually driving. And then basically the guy on the roof does the steering. So that was me. So it was pretty painful, but, the most doing it for would be sort of like 20, 25 minutes in one go. And it was tolerable. And the G-force is way less than you'd get in a race car. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was good. So I got time to recover. And the beauty with the stunt teams is, it's selfish than racing you with maybe 25 other people.
Yeah.
In the fields, and collaborating to produce something that looks awesome. So I love that, and at the end of it, you get to see it on the screen with the grading and the music. It's wicked. So yeah, love it. Great, it's a great career.
Now, what I love about the pod cars is the reason that they put you all on the roof is so that they can shoot the celebrities inside the vehicle most of the time, and there's got to be a little bit of joy you get out of, you know, trying to freak out the people downstairs just a little bit when you're going around corners. Just a wee bit of trying to scare them? Or is that just my malicious mind thinking?
Well, I generally try and do what I'm asked to do with these films. I do remember one occasion when we were working on Skyfall, very high up in the mountains in Turkey, and with a Land Rover, which isn't the most. I mean, they're pretty top heavy at the best of times. You don't want to really add weight to the roof, which is exactly what we did. So we had the Land Rover Defender with a hard top and the pod on the roof. And we were driving down this very steep ravine. We'd actually modified the suspension. We widened the wheels a bit so that it wouldn't tip over as easily. And I was, you know, told to rattle through. And Money Penny was chasing after Bond, so she was in a hurry as usual. Otherwise, they don't tend to hire me. And so, yeah, we were skating down, and this mountain was kind of covered in a clay-like mud. It's a very, very fine mud with a severe drop off the side of the mountain there that went down about 1,000 feet. So off we went, and I had an earpiece that was telling me what the dialogue was like in the car, so trying to try and also if they needed to tell me to stop, I could hear the actress. Anyway, it went very quiet, so I went back to the top, and Sanders came to the window, spoke to Naomi, who was performing the role for Money Penny, and just looked up and said, "Whatever it is you're doing, take off." He's so terrified she can't speak. So obviously that's not really helpful for making a film. But yeah, there you go. So we backed it off, and I actually, with the camera positions, the speed wasn't necessary. And once I saw what they were getting, it made sense to go a little slower.
That's awesome. So what then is kind of, I'm very curious every time, you know, I've had him. One other stunt driver on the show, I always have to ask, like, what's kind of the sketchiest, scariest thing that you've been asked to do, you know, in a car?
Sketchiest thing. Yeah, normally we try and iron out this stuff. If you're with a good crew, which I've been very fortunate, we've always had good people, you can explain what looks dangerous or wrong ahead of time and avoid a situation. But then time, you know, things kind of do sneak up on you. There was one strange one I remember doing. There was a commercial actually, and I had to back a car. I had to reverse it onto a transporter while it was moving. So, I had to drive towards it. So the transporter's going in one direction. I chased after it, spun the car 180 into reverse, then backed up, the ramps at, I think it's about 40 miles an hour. I think it could do in reverse gear. And I think we modified it a little bit to get it some extra speed. But there were no sides on the transporter, so if you got it wrong, you'd fall off the side, and there was a gap in the middle. So it would have been really easy to get that wrong, and they wanted it slick. They didn't want me, you know, screwing around, getting it lined up. It had to happen in one fluid movement, basically. And I went and do it and get in the car, and they had taken the seats out to put cameras in, but there was no chair, and I said, "What am I supposed to sit on?" And the guy looked at me and he said, "Well, you just sit on the Apple box." And he pointed to this small wooden box that was not attached to the floor. And I just laughed. I went off and saw the director and I said, "Listen, this is not happening. Because as soon as I throw it 180, I'm going to fall out of the Apple box and the car is going to crash into the transporter and it'll make just a fiery mess." So, you know, that kind of stuff. You know, but the power of no is very powerful. So you just said, "Look, I'm not doing that." And we changed it and made it work. Obviously put the chair back in, which took all of 5 minutes, adjusted the camera angle, and then whoosh, bang, we made some really cool stuff.
One of my favorite things about any sort of production is when you have, you know, there's like a bunch of people working on a production and you got like the people who are getting directions from their higher ups who then they filter it through their own mind. And then it somehow you end up with a car with an Apple box for a seat. Like, that's good enough, right? Like, no, like, this is...
Yep, it happens all the time. but that's why you have different people with different backgrounds doing the work, and you bring in car people to do car stuff. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's you've got guys who write stuff and, you know, everyone who brings things together, but you all collaborate, and as long as everyone's listening, works out. So yeah, so far so good. And you know, I love this business. It's fantastic, and we're very lucky. And actually, especially the vehicle prep side of things, that's come on a long way. And you know, I've driven things like I got to drive the Batmobile in Dark Knight Rises. There was three of us driving those things, and that had been created from a design that was on the back of a napkin, pretty much, by Chris Nolan, and given to the car guys to come up with this design. And Andy Smith got stuck into that with his team, and Chris Corbold's boys got on it as well. These special effects geniuses. And they produced from scratch this work, fully operational, fully working, the Tumbler, the Batmobile. And it was first time. So it had a V engine, automatic gearbox. And without the missiles and stuff like that, you could actually drift it pretty well through a corner. With the missiles and everything on it, it gave it too much grip. So it was a bit too tame with the weight on it. But so much fun to play with those things. Just incredible.
So you've gotten to be Batman, James Bond, the Stig, race car driver, stunt driver. I mean, is your goal just to hit all the childhood dreams before you end your career? I mean,
yes, it is. Yeah, absolutely right. You know, I mean, I love the job. It's fantastic, and these sort of boyhood dreams to be, you know, working on these movies. I mean, I've got to work on one of the Star Wars films earlier in the year. I'm absolute Star Wars nut. I mean, I grew up in California, and when Star Wars was first came out, well, pretty much just for the first one came out, and then I was there when Empire Strikes Back hit the screens, and just so hooked on that. And so to get an opportunity to work in a situation and use a skill that I've worked on for 20 years is amazing. So yeah, I love it. It's really fun. I mean, and this thing real as well. I never thought that I would last that long there. So I think I began in 2002 and stuck it out till 2010. There was a constant media presence trying to unpick who it was. And we fought off this was the, ironically, look back now, we all know what Wikipedia is. Wikipedia hadn't, when I took that job on. So that was a new problem. And then YouTube was a new problem. And all these, and camera phones were a new problem. So all that stuff kind of happens when I was trying to stay anonymous, and it was fun on one side, but I also didn't want the party to end, so there was a serious element to it. But we had a great time, and I think the last 8 years and staying anonymous on a big show like that was not a bad achievement, but thanks mostly to the people around me who helped keep it secret.
Yeah, and again, there is the man in the white suit for those of you who are listening, who, if you want more background on that, you can go give that a read. Which one of the funny things is when I sent you an email, I was like, okay, I can, you know, I'm setting up my interviews for next quarter. I got plenty of time in case he says yes to go out, get both his books and give him a read. And then when you said, can we do this week? And I said, yes. so I haven't had a chance to read the book, quite yet, which I'm going to read, and I'm going to do our first little book club on, since why not? You know, there's one question I have to ask, though, before we kind of let that topic slide, which is the one thing I was always curious about was there's an episode of Top Gear where the Stig goes on the subway during a race through London. And I was always curious if that was actually you in there or if that was some poor intern they just put in the suit and put on the subway.
Yeah, so fortunately, I mean, I think 2 days where I was away racing or something, I did all the Stig stuff from in the time I was there. And so that was me on the subway, which was great. Funnily enough, it was the broken ribs. That was about 3 days after, or 2 days after I got back from Romania. So I was walking around pretty stiff. and actually, it was quite funny when they brought me in on a sack truck. And I was in absolute agony. And very kindly, Andy Wilman, the exec producer, kind of knew that, and they got a broom handle, stuck it down my back to help support my spine, so that when they wheeled me in, I wasn't crying too loudly. So that was pretty cool. It was nice. It was a nice way to recover. Cruising around London, and it was fun. The great thing was, I really enjoyed the tiny bits of improvising that the Stig was known for. Small stuff, but you know, a lot of fun. It was a cool character to play, so we had a lot of fun doing that. Got to do some pretty weird and wonderful stuff that wasn't always driving a car. I loved it. Those are the golden years, really, up till about 2008, I think, was when Top Gear was at its most creative. And what was powering that was actually that ideas came from the ground up as well as from the top down. So that was working with the great researchers and the production team. to come up with ever crazier ideas. And, you know, they'd say, yeah, eight of those ideas are terrible, but these two are actually quite interesting. They'd change it, we'd model with something and go and film it. So it was a great time.
It does seem like a dream job. And, you know, I could spend an hour asking you questions about that, I'm sure. But I've seen you do a few other interviews. I'm trying to get some questions maybe that, you know, haven't been asked before, but maybe ask them in a new way. And what I'm kind of most curious about is you are this, you know, gentleman who's done basically everything in the automotive field that really one could want to do. And I'm wondering, how is it you got into cars in the first place? Is this something you were born into? Is this something that, like, you kind of discovered, you know, a little bit later as a child, you know, that this is something you really enjoyed? I mean, where did the passion really begin?
Yeah, I've always had a passion for speed. And I suppose the first time I felt that was being pushed in a pedal cart by my dad and my cousin, I think it was. They shoved me down a piece of tarmac and I suddenly felt of speed and just erupted with, you know, laughter. It was an instant sensation. And then, again, I was lucky enough, my family took me skiing and it was great. I mean, I there was no such thing as turning. I just went straight down as fast as possible. So I guess I was like a four, you know, around the time of Eddie the Eagle, it was the way to go. So yeah, I had that sense. And also it was mostly, I would say, my dad, because my dad drove the wheels off every single car he got hold of. So for him, the most exciting time was when he upgraded his company car. So he worked for various different businesses, and as he went through the ranks, you know, in his career, the cars got better. So I think that was probably his incentive to be, you know, to work hard, and man, did he work hard. So, and he was a bit of a loony. His foot was to the carpet in pretty much everything. One of the cars I remember was the Rover. I always get the name wrong. The SD1, is that the? I think that's the one. It looked like a Ferrari. In some respects, it's a beautiful looking car. And we would head down the drive, and he would get up to speed, and with my mother screaming at him usually, and then pull the handbrake, and we would sort of slide onto this piece of road. It was a rear wheel drive. And he kind of feathered the gas and slide, and then off we went. Overtaking as well was not, you know, he'd get past pretty much anything in through the tightest gaps. So that was, I suppose, was a force to be reckoned with, and I just enjoyed it in the back seat, just laughing and enjoying going on. And then from there, I actually wanted to be a fighter pilot, and that was for me was the dream thing. And but as it happened, that wasn't going to happen. So I got to go to a racetrack, and that was when I first really got to unleash some energy and see what happened. Actually, I've missed a piece out because I grew up on a farm, and that was a way of also getting hold of stuff and wringing its neck. So quad bikes, you know, anything that moved, I would try and get hold of it, pretending I was using some sort of practical work, something beneficial. And then just make it go as fast as possible. And so, yeah, I've been addicted to it since probably years old, I guess, something like that.
That's awesome. I'm noticing a connection between good race car drivers and skiing. There seems to be some sort of connection there. I'm going to put that together.
Yeah, definitely. It's very, very similar. You have to think and look further ahead. You've got to be able to process. Processing speed really is just the power of anticipation. And if you've got that skill of looking further ahead, then you can process the ground, and suddenly the speed doesn't feel quick. You're able to control it, and that's what human beings love doing. Mm. And with skiing particularly, you have to set up the corner well in advance. You've got to take a line. It's a racing line. It's different to what you do a million miles away. And if you're able to predict that path that you need to take, and also feel the ski sliding on the edge, it's quite similar feeling to how a tire feels when it starts to lose traction. So yeah, there's a lot of similarity with that. And one of my big heroes was Gilles Villeneuve, who came through. Obviously he could ski from Everybody who walks out the front door can ski on ice and snow. But he raced snowmobiles and gave him that incredible car control because they're sliding on the ice and snow all the time. So it's yeah, there's definitely a connection.
Well, that gave me a little bit of a idea. Is there any vehicle you won't get on and try and drive fast?
No, I love it actually. The bigger the better. The cool thing with the movies is has been getting into these bigger, chunkier vehicles, and Top Gear too. Was you know ended up driving stuff I never thought I would get to, and you kind of just start to fall in love with what they are, and some of them feel pretty unusual. Some of these big monsters feel so out of your comfort zone, but then you kind of click with what it wants. And you make some strange noises and shapes with them. So, yeah, I mean, one of the things I've still not driven a monster truck. I really want to drive a monster truck. What else am I getting into? Oh, and then for some strange reason, I've become slightly obsessed with these extreme off-road vehicles, particularly with these crazy Russian military trucks. That's become a bit of obsession since we did some filming in Iceland. Absolute beast of a machine was pulling us out of the sinking sand without completely effortlessly. And he had a brutal engine. I can't remember how many liters this engine was, but yeah, I think there could be an interesting East meets West thing. I might bring one of these over and take on the Diesel Brothers and rip their axle off in a tug of war.
That'd be awesome. So,
ooh, yeah, that's by the way. So if they do I mean business.
Well, Gauntlet Throne, I guess they got to pick it up. Have you driven a tank?
Yes, I got to drive a tank in Fury, the movie with Brad Pitt, actually, which is great. The one I was driving was kind of a replica tank of the Tiger that they take on in the final battle scene. So that's pretty amazing. But I've driven what's called an MBT, a main battle tank, in a previous life when I was training with the army and so on. I got the British version of the Abrams, the Challenger tank, which is huge, fast, very powerful, and very noisy. They're amazing machines, phenomenal power, and just the sound. It sounds like a jet engine. It's just hard to get your head around the figures and the amount of oil and fuel they burn. It's really remarkable that they are viable in a battlefield, but they somehow are. And awesome to be near. But yeah, good fun to drive as well.
Yeah, I'm gonna sit there. I'm gonna run through in my head random vehicles. I'm gonna be asking you for the rest of the interview just because something's gonna pop in my head that's gonna be crazy that you drove. So then what is the first car you learned to drive in?
That was my mum's Mitsubishi Shogun, which has a different name in America, and I can't remember what it's called, but it's basically like a Jeep. And that was pretty cool. So it was a stick shift. You had quite good vision. I grew up on the countryside, so we had like tight lanes to look through, and you kind of that vision helped. With my mum, actually, is my teacher. You know, and she was pretty vicious when I got it wrong. Quite rightly, I got it wrong a lot because I was in a hurry. And so she used to hit me as hard as possible with her hammer, which is a training tool. I strongly recommend it. Always listen to your parents; they're the best teachers for your early driving career. Yeah, I think to be honest, though, I think my mother was very relieved when I passed my driving test, and she didn't have to sit next to me anymore. So God bless her. Then. Ever grateful that she started me on that journey.
Well, yeah, did you pass your driving test on the first go?
Did, yeah, and I was again fortunate that I'd spent enough time practicing with my mum. So I had three official lessons and then passed first time, which in retrospect probably was not a good thing because I then went on and crashed. My car in the first year because I thought I knew it all and I didn't know it all. You know, it's one thing having car control and being able to drive fast, but the other is the big lesson is knowing when not. And that was the lesson I learned the hard way because I'm stupid. So that's the sort of experience I've written about a lot in so the How to Drive book. It really is I suppose it's the book I wish I'd read as a kid before I went driving. And so I've gone into the detail of the kind of mistakes I made in hope that I can learn from them and avoid the same mistakes, as well as all the fun experiences I've had over the years working in film and with TV racing, learning about how to control a car and how to control your brain and make the most of the journey, because for most people, driving is good fun and make them. So yes, I passed first time, but my attitude had not caught up with the physical skill at that time.
What kind of car was it that you crashed?
I crashed a few, actually, if I'm honest. So there was Civic. I crashed that. And then about a year later, I had a sponsorship deal, in fact, and it was a Toyota Supra, which I managed to fold up. And what else was there? And in the first season of my racing, I destroyed three of the cars I was in. I rolled one. I put one in a barrier. I got edged off the track into a wall at 120 miles an hour, which was there was nothing left of the car. It was just like a piece of a bathtub. And I think after the third one, realized that I needed to adjust my sort of strategy. And after that, I started winning. So the speed was there. It was just kind of focusing how, because I'd never raced before. So it was the big thing was sharing that space with other people and trying to hit them.
Yeah. Sorry about that. I'm sure you heard that, but that's I shouldn't have gone off.
That's okay. I think that was your stomach telling you it's time to eat breakfast.
Yeah, basically. No, that was my little Fitbit telling me, hey, well, now's the time you actually are supposed to get up. So we're that's how early it is. So if you got a few more minutes, I know you might be on a bit of a time crunch today.
Yeah.
We can run through some quick questions here from, some audience type folk. One of the questions, and I'm sure this is something that you can't answer, but I have to ask anyway, is will we be seeing you perhaps on any Grand Tour test drive coming up? They've been putting out a few videos of people they got to be the new race car driver over there, and it seems like you'd be a natural fit.
Do you know what? It's interesting, that one. And so there have been conversations, and I thought that would have been a really cool role, in fact. So, but as it turns out, I think they've gone a different direction. So it was strange. I was going to be doing some stuff with those guys, and then I think Richard had the terrible accident, and literally we were about to do something the following day, which would have been really fun. But then Richard had his crash. Fortunately, he was okay, but he bashed his leg up. So that didn't happen. And then, things progress and different ideas take over. So I've had a lot of fun with those guys over the years. And we did a really fun piece when they left Top Gear as a kind of segue. And I played the role of the tramp Stig, which was great fun and very popular in their live shows. So, yeah, no, I think I'm intrigued now because they've done some good fun bits. I enjoyed the stunt driver assessment when he crashed the car, and then Mark Webber in recently. So I'm curious to see who they do go for in the end. Mm-hmm. Because I think it could be, who knows where it's coming from, but probably left field.
Yeah. One of the...
But there might be another show. You never know.
That's true. There's a lot of new good car shows coming out, and I'm sure eventually we're going to see you on one of those again. So...
Yeah, I hope so. There's some great shows coming up. There's Top Gear being reborn. There's all kinds of different shows. Wheeler Dealers is doing very well in the States, which is fantastic. Discovery have got a new show. So, the one thing that's come out of Top Gear breaking up into kind of a number of different outlets is that I think people are less afraid to give it to try the format. And Top Gear needed to change. The format had really gone on unchanged for a very, very long time. It kind of lived its life, and it was time to change. So, yeah, I think there'll be a fresh take on it, and I'd love to be part of that. So, mm-hmm. Fingers crossed, there'll be something happening soon.
Who would have known that one lack of a steak dinner was all it took to make the automotive world explode with a plethora of new car shows? So, E.L. Yuli, I have to ask this one, says, Which celebrity made you the most nervous while teaching them to lap the Top Gear circuit?
I forgot his name now. No, I do. That would be Jimmy Carr. But the comedians were pretty scary. I don't know. I think Jimmy Carr does. He's probably known in the US. He's extremely hilariously funny.
Yeah.
But a strange thing with the comedians, I don't know what it is, but they have no sense of survival at all. They don't have a survival instinct. We'd be spinning backwards, you know, kind of like there'd be a tractor or something parked off track. And you think, we're never going to hit that. But with Jimmy Carr, you thought, this guy could actually find a way of hitting that thing. With complete carefree attitude. So he'd just be laughing his head off as we spun backwards at 100 miles an hour. And I'd be there pulling pathetically on the handbrake to try and get the thing to stop and shouting, brake, brake, you know. But yeah, he was oblivious to the danger and carried on. But, you know, I knew that I only had to be with him for about 15, 20 minutes. And once he was relatively safe, get out, walk to a safe distance, and then and it was on him. And I said to him, you know, you're dangerous, just be careful. So I'm sure he really listened to that.
Miss Mercedes, one of the fans, asks, how do you feel about the different smart cars and their performance values? So have you driven smart cars, all of them?
What is a smart car?
The little Mercedes Swatch team up, like it's the little city car, the little micro car. It's called a smart car.
Oh, you mean?
Yeah.
You mean specifically the Mercedes smart car?
Yeah, the little smart car. Yeah.
Oh, what do I think of that? Yeah, they're okay. You know, if you had two of them, you'd have a whole car. but no, they are great for what they do. They do a job very well, because you can park them extremely easily. I mean, funnily enough, though, if you look back, I hadn't realised that, but back in the '70s, they were doing these tiny cars like the Peel, absolutely tiny.
Yeah. Like,
you know, I don't know why we don't make, I suppose, well, yeah, really small, tiny engines, very
efficient. Yeah.
Fit these things everywhere. They look slightly ridiculous, but yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think that is pretty clever. I'm surprised that there isn't more of them, particularly with the dawn of electric, that we haven't got some very, very small cars with people creeping around in them. So yeah, I think they're part of the way forward.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's, you gave me a little brainwave there. So, because I actually really adore small cars. I used to have two big muscle cars. You know, I own two Dodge Challengers. And then I went from that and wound my a few cars later into my current car, my little Fiesta ST. So, if you were going to buy a small car, you know, just to tool around in, is there a particular one you like?
Not yet, no.
No.
I hope that, I think, still, if I have one of those 1970s model, they're incredibly simple. They've got like an engine from a lawnmower. There's not much that can go wrong with them. I think you get a tax break using that. Not that that's a reason to necessarily do anything, but they're just, yeah, they were very, very simple, very intuitive to drive. They're fun. I could rave about them all day long. Whereas some of the modern stuff now, we're very disconnected with the electric power steering and all this other stuff. You know, I think, yeah, there's nothing wrong with having a small car. If I bought small, I'd try and get something from the 70s. There's tons of them. Even some of the old Fiats. You look at the new Fiat 500 and put it next to the old one, you realize, wow, they fit more car into a smaller space in the old days. So, yeah, they had it right back in the, some of the older designs, still very, very good.
Mm-hmm. I occasionally pop online. I'm like, I wonder how much I can get like an old Fiat Abarth 600 for. Like, I think that's the one with like the like old hood, like welded completely open. Because why not?
Yeah, you should get yourself out for a road trip and get some of those and take them home. They're wonderful cars, really great, and some of them are very well looked after. So I think that could be the next classic car bubble.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I got two questions I kind of want to finish out here with then. So, first one is another fan question, which is, the crazy Canuck wants to know what your automotive guilty pleasure is. So.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Guilty pleasure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I do love off-roading, so that's become a newer thing. I've got myself a relatively old Army Land Rover, we have these by roads. I mean, in America, you've got the deserts and all kinds of places where you can really let rip. In the UK, things are more restricted, and I'm lucky I'm both sides of the Atlantic. But yes, I like going off-road in my Land Rover and making advantage of these byways, which basically cut through between the main roads. So you've got the tarmac, the blacktop stuff, for kind of like roads, which are grown and covered in all kinds of. You can, if you've got the right, you can smash through all that stuff. So that's become a new passion.
And then last question, and it's something I really want to know, is, you know, you've grown up on both sides of the Atlantic, and I think this is a little bit more of an American phenomenon, but I'm sure you've taken a bunch of road trips. Do you have a best or worst road trip story?
But the end result was I went to race at a place called Bathurst, which is this very wild on the planet, maybe just after Macau in Hong Kong. And so this is Australia. And we did a trip from Melbourne up to Sydney in a 1952 Chevy with two friends of mine, Rick and Todd Kelly, who race in the V8 Supercar Series down there. Imagine a NASCAR, but with skinnier tires, racing on this wild mountain road. That's the track, but we got through the outback, and it was absolutely incredible. Beautiful scenery, but just endless, and just exploring Australia. So that was pretty amazing. The curious thing was the presence of the police on the roads out there was surprising, because you'd be enjoying a road or whatever, and you really have to be very careful with your speed, because the police were really onto that. So, and rightly so. But I thought I was quite surprised. You could be in the middle of absolute nowhere, and sure enough, there'd be somebody there with a speed gun. So you feel very watched. But yeah, it was a phenomenal experience, and we got to really play with this huge beast of a car and take turns driving. So a lot of stupid talk took place, and it's kind of like, I think it must have been about 8 hours or more of driving. So we had a great time.
That's awesome. I do find it slightly ironic. You're saying you felt like you're being watched, but you spend time in London where there's a CC camera on you at all times. So
yeah. Well, the great thing about the US is that people are very intolerant of entire time. UK, I kind of despair, but we've got, I think there's 41 million cameras watching us on the streets, and it's out of control. So yeah, stick with the land of the free, and keep up what you guys are doing, because you're doing it right.
Maybe not everything right over here. A couple things to change. I think that's a good place to end it, because I'm losing my voice for some reason. Ben Collins, I keep wanting to call you Sir Ben Collins, but I think that's not right.
I'd like that, but no, we better not. We better not.
We don't want to upset the Queen.
Yeah. No, I'll take X Dig. That's fine.
Yeah. Which is a better title? You will forever be my Stig.
I'm doing some stuff. That's great. I'm glad. As long as I've got, I'm going to start the day on the right foot.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining me this evening. This morning. Man, I am off on that one. A few hours. I'm going to say goodbye to you off air in here in just a moment. But for people who want to know what you're up to, where should they go and what should they look at?
Well, that's a good question. So this last year, I worked on American Assassin, which has just come out. So there's some fun car chases in that and an amazing fight scenes that my buddy Buster Reeves coordinated, and he coordinated the stunt and action scenes there. So there's good car stuff I got to work on. So that's coming out, or that's out on cinemas and coming out. What else did I work on? Some of the Star Wars next year. And hopefully some more TV. So actually we'll do some more filming with Jay Leno, who is the most fantastic. Love working with him. And I'm back out in the States in a week or so for some more fun and frolics with Jay. So that'll be coming out early next year. So all good. It's good stuff to look forward to.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. And you have a Twitter, I believe, as well. I know you got a Twitter. I'm just trying to pull it up in my head real fast here. Is it at Ben Collins?
So there's that at Ben Collins Stig. I sometimes throw some photos out on Instagram as well, which is the same handle, and on Facebook. So I think it's Ben Collins. So there's always something fun happening, and I'll try and keep people entertained with showing what's happening. But mostly looking forward to next year. What that's going to bring. It's going to be cool movies, and I think there's it's great. It's a good time.
All right. Excellent. Well, Ben, hang on a second. I'm going to say goodbye to you off air. Everyone who's listening, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back. Hey, everyone. Make sure you check out TrackMonkeyApparel.com for awesome shirts and, other items over there. Go check out their constantly updating everything they have over there. Make sure, if you like what you heard today, you tell a friend, loved one, coworker, just someone you think might be interested in the show. So I want to thank Ben again for coming on the show. We're going to have an announcement about the book club coming up to read his two books. And, just thanks everyone so much for listening. Again, you can follow the show at Untitled Car Show on all social media. You can follow our West Coast correspondent. He does the Instagram and he does the Twitter under his own name at Ryan West. So that's Ryanator at Ryanator122. Follow the show, leave a review on iTunes. We'll get around to reading those eventually. And just share the love. Thanks everyone so much for listening. It's episodes like this, which, I really love doing what I get to do, asking these people who've done amazing things, silly questions like, what's the hardest thing to eat in a car? So thanks everyone so much for listening. Have a good night. Have a good evening. Wherever you are, whatever time it is there, thank you so much for listening. Please be safe out there.